Okay, we're so glad you're back with us for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Dr. Stephen Lieb from The Complete Investor. My featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Lieb, 25 years of investment experience. I bet it's more than that by now. Just finished up his gold magnum opus. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate being here, and I wish I'd only been in the business 25 years, but it's longer than that. I won't say how much.
We were talking before the show, and I wanted to get all this interesting information in about your latest tome that has been accepted by the publisher.
Not quite that yet, but I have a good feeling it will be. I do have one of the top agents in the country. It's one thing I share with Michael Lewis is that we have the same agent. We don't have the same writing skills, unfortunately, but we do have the same agent. He does like the book very much, and we're confident that we'll sell it. And unlike other books that I have written in the past, this one is largely written. We have to add things here and there. And when you're talking about something as current as gold, virtually every week another item comes up that you have to incorporate. I think we actually will get this book out in fairly short order. And I'm hoping that it will help a lot of people and encourage them to, broaden their asset base a bit. Gold is a much neglected asset in this country. And I think it's going to be the cornerstone of our monetary system. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be headed any other way than toward something other than the dollar, something other than reserve currencies. I hate to use the phrase fiat currency, but it's there. It's paper money. I never thought I would be talking like this. I have to say that it is as an aside. If you known me 10 or 15 years ago, I mean, this is such a foreign speech for me to be talking about fiat currencies and gold and precious metals as being a cornerstone for our monetary system and for our economy. But the world has changed just in ways that were hard to imagine. But here we are, circa 2016, and we're faced with a situation unlike any that we've ever seen. It's going to imply a lot more changes to come, and I think gold will be at the center of many of those changes.
Firstly, hat tip, we'd certainly love to see your book become also a smash hit movie.
Never match Michael Lewis. I've told my agent, no. That's one thing that we share in common, and the only thing we share in common. Michael Lewis and I have the same agent, but that's it. Beyond that, he's a magnificent writer, a magnificent reporter. I'm much more an academic. I just don't have his, magical writing touch. But I think what I say, does turn out to be pretty good. And I have kept people, I think by and large in pretty good shape over the past times that I've been in the business. I hope to continue to do so in the future. My reads are not necessarily fun reads. So that, I will say that in all fairness. But yes, I do share the same agent as Michael Lewis. I'm proud to admit, yes.
I don't know how fun The Big Short was to read. I guess it depends on your perspective. If you were short the housing market and didn't watch your family lose like over 10 million U.S. families to home foreclosures, it's really more of a Stephen King like horror story.
It is, and it's and Michael Lewis. There's a lot to learn from Michael Lewis. I mean, you can't take. I think it's hard to take specific investment advice from him. The book before. I can't remember whether it was before or came right after The Big Short. I think it came actually after The Big Short, which was Flash Boys, talking about making money in nano trading. I mean, that says something right there about America. I mean, here you have trading people competing with each other in terms of literally nanoseconds. Who gets the order on the to the machines first, wins the prize. That's not a recipe for productivity. And, of course, I mean, The Big Short, really speaks for itself. I mean, it was a movie, and I thought a very, very good movie, a very instructive movie. On display in that movie is the decadence involved in capitalism. you know, the willingness of these rating agencies to rate these combination of mortgage bonds as AAA. I mean, I thought he just did a brilliant job in you know, capitalism, you know, unfettered. How easy it is just to create money out of nothing, and how people, you know, can lose, the entire system can lose. And it was certainly on the brink of losing. And, you know, I think displayed a system, you know, nearly bankrupt. And I fear that we're going to go through another type of crisis similar to that. Maybe after we get done with that crisis, we'll have more of a foundation. We will sort of have hit bottom and maybe have more of a foundation to go forward. You know, the tragedy of what happened in 2008, 2009, it just doesn't seem we've learned anything about it from it. It seems like we're going to make the same kinds of mistakes. Recently, I would say within the past 2 weeks, for the first time in my life, I mean, I worry about things, children, you know, whatever, family, et cetera. And sometimes it keeps you up at night, and you'll wake up at night and you'll be worried about, you know, something or other that's related to you and your family. But I have never, ever, until I would say 2 weeks ago, woken up worried desperately about the economy, the world's economy. I look at these negative interest rates, which are affecting, I think, majority of sovereign bonds now are trading at negative interest rates. This is just, things are changing, and they're changing, you know, in a way that's certainly pointing toward a major, a sort of seismic shift in how we govern our economies. And, you know, much of the change is involved in a lot shifting from west to east. And I think we're sort of starting to recognize that, but I think China is going to have a huge, massive role in the world's economy. And I think there's just very little doubt about that. And it doesn't mean that we have to be left in its shadows, but it means that we have to, you know, really change our ways and, you know, sort of start repairing water pipes, start putting up new grid, start, you know, investing in infrastructures that can really put America back to work again and, you know, start increasing our productivity. We're not doing any of the above. And, you know, the costs are just enormous. The costs are negative productivity, all this money and no place to invest because no one can agree and everybody has so much debt as a result of it. I mean, it just goes on and on. So, yeah, I think we're on the cusp of a very, very significant change.
You know, you brought up some great topics there, and one of them, negative interest rates. There is some talk that eventually, even the U.S., I mean, look, we've got Japan with Shinzo Abe's regime now with much more power and control, and they obviously are pro-negative rates and QE, and of course the EU is just trying to hold things together. I had this interesting conversation with an executive a couple of days ago, and he directed me to this term called the Metropolitan Club. But apparently there's a fifth floor on the Metropolitan Club outside of New York, where the world's wealthiest have a tendency to congregate. And there is some talk that a new Jekyll Island-like discussion has either taken place or is in negotiation. If negative rates ever come to the United States, a gold backing of some sort to our currency. Have you heard anything of this?
Vaguely have, yes. I mean, and I think the question is, how much gold do we have? And are we able to do that? I'm not sure we are, to be very, very honest. You know, there's a question as to whether we even have the 8,000 tons of gold in this country to do any sort of backing. We may, and we may not. I think we're as opaque as the Chinese when it comes to how much gold we have. And that would be a very, very important question. But yes, if the gold were there, I mean, A, I have heard stories like that. B, the credibility of such a story would rest upon how much gold. Can we actually do that? I'm not sure. I mean, you know, how about backing currencies and rare earths? Of course, we would never do that, but we don't have them. I mean, we have them, but they're totally undeveloped in this country, and it would take Manhattan-like projects to do it. I mean, I don't want to get too much adrift, but what I'm saying, much depends upon whether we have the gold or silver or, you know, anything like that. We certainly don't import gold, from what I know. Whatever gold we have would be, I think, that original 8,000 tons. I don't think we've added to it. On the other hand, I think the Chinese have much, much more gold than you know, we realize. Two very disparate things, but I think they illustrate more or less the same. It has been the growth. It's not my chart. It comes from Nature magazine, so it's, you know, very well-grounded. Between 2000 and now, 2015, actually last year, China has grown its supercomputer industry. This is a very high-tech industry. It has grown it from one supercomputer to 168. In the same period of time, our supercomputer industry has fallen from 250 to 165. In other words, China now has more supercomputers than the United States. Not only that, for the last 7 or 8 years, China's computers, supercomputers, have been faster than ours, and they are much faster than ours right now. What this has allowed China to do is basically, and I don't think a lot of people know this, China right now is the largest electronic money processor in the world. They process more money than Visa and MasterCard. They probably process about as much as Visa now, but by the end of the year, they will process more. They issue more credit cards than Visa and MasterCard combined. The company that does this rose right along with the supercomputers. It's called China UnionPay, or CUP, C-U-P. It's just a remarkable feat that this company started from nothing and now basically is on the verge of dominating electronic money processing. You know, another fact is that you hear a lot about bitcoins and virtual currencies. Well, guess who dominates that industry? China. And they do that by virtue of, I think, at least part and parcel of it, is their leading position of supercomputers. You need supercomputers to help with the software that defines the virtual currencies. You need supercomputers to help with the massive amount of processing that goes on with these credit cards and debit cards. And they're there, and they're getting bigger and bigger in this. And sort of my argument, I mean, one of my arguments would be any country that can go from one to number one, literally, from nowhere, number one to hegemony, in a brief period of time, can in that same relatively brief period of time accumulate massive amounts of gold. All we know now about China's gold holdings is that they're almost surely much higher than China admits. Regular news agencies or news agencies that are trustworthy, you know, come up with estimates that are higher than that. And Bloomberg and other agencies that don't have kind of a bent that, you know, would let them say, well, China's, you know, doing things that, you know, you wouldn't expect them to do. When you step back, the only thing you know about China, Chris, and potential gold is that they hold about $1.2 trillion in treasury securities, bills, bonds, and notes. Their total reserves, their reserves have gone down, but still, when you, if you count their sovereign wealth fund, you end up with about $4 trillion in total foreign reserves. That's what they say they have. They don't tell you how they're divided. They got a free pass on that. Every other country has to say how their reserves are allocated. China does not. So there you have $2.8 trillion in reserves in which we don't know how they're allocated. They also have another $3 trillion in bank deposits by just government agencies have left the equivalent of $3 trillion in Chinese banks, probably to backstop debt. But, you know, who knows what they're going to, you know, how they've invested that money. They also have an additional $3 trillion, the Chinese banks, deposited with the PBOC. This is what we do know. And that gives them nearly $9 trillion. That's enough money to buy all the gold in the world. Now, I don't think they've bought all the gold in the world. Obviously not. But it gives them the wherewithal to have bought massive amounts of gold. Whether they have or not, I don't know. And how much they have, I don't know. But I know that they certainly could own massive amounts of gold at this point. We have to be very conscious of that. Now, if the Metropolitan Club is saying that we own, instead of 8,000 tons of gold, which I don't think would do a whole lot, well, 8,000 tons of gold that in today's world is worth about $380 billion. It's a small percentage of our GDP. If they own the 8,000, yeah, maybe we could do a little bit with that. But if China has, let's say, 20,000 tons of gold, 25, who knows? I mean, they're just in a much, much better position. And, you know, given their position in things like virtual currencies, in things like credit processing, debit processing, it's something that, you know, I don't think that we grasp. And I'm not sure that the people at the Metropolitan Club do, but they may know something I don't know. But I do think that China could be in an incredibly good position at this point. You know, their ambitions are to, you know, build out the entire East, literally with this One Belt, One Road, and, you know, to do a lot of that with gold. I mean, the acquiring of gold is not just confined to China. It's also it's also part of Russia's policy, and it's also, you know, endemic in the eastern part of the world. They like gold. The West doesn't particularly like gold. You know, I'm just offering, you know, a counter to those that, you know, think that the U.S. can do that. But yes, I have heard those rumors that we're thinking of doing something with gold. I'm just not sure that we're in a position to do something with gold. That would be my question. It wouldn't be that I know. I mean, I think too much of this is opaque. I do know China's in probably a better position than us to have accumulated massive, massive amounts of gold over the past, I don't know, 5 or 10 years.
It's such an interesting perspective, and I'd like to give our listeners some context here. I mean, we're talking about the potential for 20,000 tons, 25,000. Now, this is difficult, even with numbers behind it or dollar signs behind it, to grasp. But here's some perspective. You know, we have roughly 10,000 tons in the United States, and it's universally known as the world's largest stockpile. If, again, we believe it's there, it's unencumbered, it hasn't been leased out. And we've heard some interesting commentary from, of course, yourself and Dr. Ron Paul. But if you're right, I mean, this is a strategic advantage that would be incomparable if it's 20, 30,000 tons. I mean, it could be virtually any number. And another interesting aspect to this tale, we regularly have folks from Hong Kong, Peru, Saxon, and others, and they're talking about huge inflows, almost immeasurable amounts of tonnage of gold flowing from Hong Kong into the mainland.
Yes, have been, and exports from Hong Kong to China, yes, are part of it. You know, remarkably, there it's not that much of a part of it. They get gold from all sorts of sources. I mean, the Swiss export gold to them, Britain exports gold to them. It's basically comes from many, many different places. I mean, and the estimates from people that are very, very smart. I mean, for instance, I think just this year, there's a Singapore website that talks about how much gold China has gathered. And this doesn't count the PBOC. This doesn't count monetary gold. This just counts gold for investment. And they figure about, well, they figured last year about 2,500 tons, I think. And Nomura, the brokerage firm who's credible, they figured about over 4,000 tons. So, I mean, you know, it just varies all over the place. China is very good at keeping secrets. And, you know, part and parcel of this, again, I'm just thinking about this, could be their expertise in these supercomputers, which allow them sort of an advantage in, you know, hiding flows. If they're leasing, if they have dollar deposits and they use that to, you know, basically secure options on gold in the future, I mean, anything is possible. It's sort of beyond my pay grade to think of all the possibilities. But I do come up, Chris, very straightforwardly with nearly $9 trillion that China has, that would be enough to basically buy all the gold in the world at what the current price of about $13.20. They don't own all the gold in the world. I'm quite sure of that, but they could own a much larger percentage of that gold than anyone thinks is possible.
As you say, all kinds of possibilities. And one of them, with your supercomputer idea, also mentioning bitcoins, well, of course, that involves encryption.
That's exactly exactly right. Yes, yes. Sorry. I mean, yes, you've got it. Yes.
I was thinking of another strategic advantage. We saw what, you know, Alan Turing did for the Allies against the Axis, and that was almost 100, I don't want to say 100 years ago, but 80 years ago.
Well, he was rewarded for doing it.
Yeah, what a terrible reward. That's a shame, but at least they recognize that, whereas so many unsung heroes have been lost. And this really gives China such a strategic advantage. And again, we can learn from this. We don't have to fear it.
Yes, I think that you're right. One thing that we have to be happy about is that China does not have to be an enemy of ours. I mean, China is not an acquisitive power. They're not seeking to acquire anything more than what they need to be secure in their own country. You know, they consider themselves, or they're best viewed, I think, as sort of a nation civilization, if you will. China goes back three or four or five, I don't know how many millennia. They've spoken the same language. They're the same familiar structure. I mean, there's so much about this civilization which has stayed in place for so long. Happy to do that. And what they're trying to do is build the structure and the infrastructure, I believe, for a prosperous 21st century for them. That does not have to mean a bad 21st century for America, you know, unless we make it so. So, I mean, I think China's success and ascension in today's world does not have to be a bad thing for us, but it does mean that we have to wake up and we have to, you know, get with it, and we have to start investing in things we need to invest in. I mean, Chris, productivity, I mean, the last three quarters we've had negative productivity in this country. That, you know, no country can last for long with those kinds of statistics. It's that simple.
That is something that technology has a tendency to boost productivity.
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't maybe redirect the discussion back to the precious metals and your upcoming tome. We don't want you to give too much away, nothing proprietary. You've already woven some of the interesting topicality into this discussion today. We don't have to look too far out, I suppose, or speculate too much in either direction, but maybe the type of economic situation that might lead to better years ahead for the precious metals.
Well, I think that what will lead to better years ahead for, you know, a lot of things will be, you know, building out infrastructure and trying to, you know, allocate commodities to infrastructure building and investment. I mean, the East right now is wholly undeveloped. I mean, basically, you have a world in which about 17% of the population controls, I don't know, 75% of the wealth. That other 80% or so of the world controls very little of the wealth. You're going to see a shift there. You're going to see higher commodity prices. You may see scarcity. You're going to have intense focus on investing in the right kinds of things. I mean, just as one example that I've used in many, many cases, this country is still rich in a lot of resources, yet every year you look at the USGS, United States Geophysical Survey, and you find that we are importing more and more commodities. And, you know, one group of commodities which has been talked to death, but it should be talked to death. I mean, it should be more than talked to death. I mean, we should take action on it, are rare earths. I mean, rare earths are essential to our military, essential to almost much of what we do in modern life requires magnetism, and rare earths are the shortest way to permanent magnets, and they're the best way. And we have massive deposits of rare earths. We don't have any universities in this country which really offer programs in rare earth engineering. I mean, it's very difficult to take a deposit of rare earths and turn what you get out of that deposit into a permanent magnet. That's another major advantage China has, incidentally. I think they are the only country on the face of the earth. They have massive rare earth deposits. They're the only country that can actually take a rare earth deposit and turn it into a product, a permanent magnet, which can sit in a computer, which can sit in a car, car, which has all sorts of applications. We can't do that, but it's not for lack of resources. It's for lack of willingness to spend the money to or invest the money, you know, like we did with the interstate highway system, like we did with the Manhattan Project. I think this would be much more than a Manhattan Project, and it would employ so many people in productive tasks and would give this country, you know, much, much greater independence. I mean, right now, I mean, I hate to say this, we're very dependent on China for these very, very special minerals and commodities. You know, that's one direction that we must head in. We must develop these new industries. And we must be, you know, prepared to, you know, invest or, you know, use our best brains to in cyber warfare, cybersecurity, you know, things like that, which have just, you know, we've just let drop. In the chaos of the political system, we sort of have lost track as to what has made America great, a sort of willingness to come together, build an interstate highway system, build Apollo, you know, going to the moon, the Manhattan Project, which, you know, basically was essential in the Second World War. We've been leaders in many, many areas, but we have sort of lost that sense of drive, and we've got to somehow reacquire that, I mean, in order to exist in this new century.
Don't you think that these programs you discuss, which I agree with you, I mean, they were my inspiration early on, you know, the Apollo mission, then, of course, followed by the space shuttle, and let's not forget the Hubble Deep Space Telescope.
Absolutely.
Much of that, I'm sure, was a partnership with the EU and other nations. And unfortunately, I think a big part here comes when the populace is experiencing economic distress. For instance, you know, look at CERN. To be involved with this, you know, this Higgs boson discovery and all of that. I mean, how exciting. And we used to have that. We had the Fermi Lab not far from where you grew up. Yeah, your stomping ground.
Yes, exactly right. And a lot of good work came out of there. You know, what I do remember at the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was a proposal to build a massive collider like CERN. I mean, I don't know, I can't compare the sizes.
You are correct. And it was built, but they couldn't complete it because they ran out of funding.
Consortium of private and government money. You know, who knows what they would have discovered by now? You know, where we are participating, we're not participating in CERN, and we're not participating to any extent in these experiments on nuclear fusion. You know, rare earths I just picked because it's something that I've studied, but, you know, you're absolutely right about these colliders. I mean, you know, so much good and knowledge can come out of that, and who knows how that knowledge is going to, you know, work, but you've got to be willing to try. I mean, so much has come out of the Apollo programs. I mean, talk about Bell Labs, Chris. Bell Labs now is just not even a shadow of itself. It's a mini shadow of itself. But I mean, everything from lasers to the internet, literally to the transistor, to, you know, all our modern technology came out of basically a semi-private organization, AT&T. They sponsored, you know, all this incredible research, which has laid the foundation for a lot of our basic IT, information technology. And there's no more Bell Labs. We've got to get back to what made us great. And I think hopefully we can. And maybe this shifting tide toward China right now will wake us up again and maybe force us to come together.
And this is so important because, you know, having reentered academia about 6 years ago after a long hiatus, there's been a real sea change. As you say, a huge influx of folks from China and from other nations with a great passion for physics, mathematics, and I'm talking advanced mathematics and economics.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, the articles, all the peer-reviewed journal articles in that area, and we can learn those skills, a mindset, a change in our mindset here in the U.S.
It absolutely will. I mean, you know, we don't have to play Pokemon. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, it's like I have a friend that's said that, you know, Trump should not build a wall between Mexico and the U.S. He should build a wall around the Ivy League because they're the most, you know, politically correct, you know, institutions in this country, and it's stultifying. I mean, I'm all for equality for everybody. I mean, I think we're all different and we're all whatever. I mean, I have a very Quaker-like philosophy about the world. What's happening when you can't, you know, talk and collaborate, and without making sure every I is dotted and T is crossed, and no one is insulted. I mean, this is not America. I mean, it doesn't inspire people. Something that we need to wake ourselves up and become a civilization. I mean, we need to work together if that's possible. I think that, hopefully we can, but I don't see it happening now. And you talk about China again. My son, I'm happy that, one of the people he's working with is a graduate. He has his PhD and he's doing like a postdoc and something. But one of the people he's working with is this Chinese woman who came from the University of Peking. And you know what the acceptance rate is at the University of Peking? I'll give you a hint. At Harvard, it's about 54 out of 1,000. Okay, that's at Harvard. Do you know what it is at the University of Peking? 1 in 1,000. There are two universities that have that same acceptance rate. And to get in there, it's not a question of having the right father or the right legacy. It's a question of doing incredibly well on a particular exam. They're a meritocracy. We used to be a meritocracy. We're not anymore. Because of that, I think we're losing ground. The people running China, the premier of China, Li, who, not Xi, but Li, she also is an incredibly accomplished guy. But Li, in particular, the fellow who I think is still in charge of the economy in China, he's a graduate of the University of Peking, and he won the award in China for the best PhD dissertation. So this is who they select to, be the man in charge of the economy at the in China, the best that they have, the most skilled economist, basically. Who do we select in this country? I mean, they're, some people are very good, but some people are not, et cetera. I mean, China basically is a meritocracy. And it doesn't mean that people that can't afford or don't have those skills to, be the best in physics are just, cast away. They're not. They're given other things. They fulfill their lives in other ways. But we have no way right now of making sure that the best or the most equipped or the people that really enjoy it more, whatever it takes to do well on a test. I'm not saying anything about intelligence or anything like that, but there's a certain motivation that it takes, a certain willingness to study, study hard. We basically have lost that. It's something that we've got to get back again. I mean, the people that rose to, prominence in this country, the Gordon Moores, the Bardeens, who, superconductivity, I mean, the names go on, but they're all names that I think, came from, let's say, the pre-1960 era or the pre-1970 era. We've got to get back to that era where science is revered, and it's not revered because it allows people to, communicate with their friends via Facebook, people that they don't know, and establish these relations. I mean, we've got to get back to, nuts and bolts and the things that have made this country great. I think we can. I think, unfortunately, 2008-09 could have been a big wake-up call for it, but it just didn't turn out that way. And I think the next crisis will probably be the one that does wake us up. I'm still hopeful about America. I mean, I love so much about this country I love. I'm just unwilling to give up on it. So that's one of the reasons I write this book, to try and wake people up. And it has to start with a willingness to sort of bridge the gap between, what one side is saying and what the other side is saying. I mean, I've taken to saying, when people say, well, who are you a Democrat or Republican? I said, I'm an American. And I think it has to be more that attitude. I mean, a more willingness to come together and work together as one, and less a sense of entitlement. Yes, I think that there's just, I agree with what you're saying, in short. I do. I think it's well put.
And I think we've covered a lot of the bases today, and certainly you are looking for better times ahead for the precious metals. So as we wrap up, if you don't mind, share any information you'd like to about maybe websites or services.
Right. I think liebinvestor.com would be the place where you would go, if you wanted to, see, the stuff that we do. But I'm much more concerned that you sort of like take to heart the kinds of stuff that we're talking about here and realize that, you know, we do have to come together and stop the fighting.
It's so important, you know, and let's turn off the nonsense, you know, on the screen, pick up a book or do some serious reading. I mean, we've got to get away from, I think, that culture. And that's maybe a topic for another show.
It is, but you're right on that. You are so right.
Dr. Stephen Leib, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Golden silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.